Welcome to Should Have Bet More podcast presented by Gold Boys. Coming up on the show, Andy McCullough of The Athletic will join us. He has a new book on Clayton Kershaw, so we'll spend some time talking baseball. I haven't talked baseball in a little bit, so I'll spend some time on baseball with Andy. And in a few minutes, I'll give you some thoughts because I do think there's a bet out there that's just completely mispriced that I really like. But I'll start here with the NBA as we are down to four teams in each conference. The one series that went seven is the one that really nobody wanted to see any more of, and that is the Cavs, the Magic. Cavs end up winning, down big early, down I think as much as 17, 18, and end up winning the game and winning it pretty comfortably. Orlando just couldn't score in the second half. Let's be honest, this series was painful to watch, absolutely, like watching paint dry, both of these teams. There was a lot of pressure on the Cavs because what they gave up for Mitchell, they tanked to get the Magic. And they will advance. They will get buried by the Celtics, barring some sort of injury to Tatum. Boston will either sweep or win in five. Boston doesn't seem to sweep anybody, but that will not be much of a series as that will get going here in a couple of days. The other series, at least in the West, are good. Minnesota landed a haymaker because they steal home court right away. First score I saw, and the game started earlier than I thought. Thought it was like an 8-9 o'clock game, which was supposed to be, but I guess because it was the only game, they started a little earlier. Minnesota's up 18-4. You figure they're in good shape. Before you could blink, I think it's like 31-27 Denver, and you say, all right, Denver answered the punch. Denver's in good shape here. Minnesota shows a lot of toughness, you know, losing at halftime, and they just win the game and win it, not going away, but win it pretty decisively and take a one game to nothing lead, take home court. They are now minus 130 in some spots to win the series, minus 150 in other spots. Oh, truth is probably somewhere in between there. Now, look, we've seen this a lot. When a team wins game one on the road, they usually get buried in game two, almost always. The team that's down 0-1, they need the game. First of all, they're usually better because they do have the home court. So this is usually, you know, the better team. They come out motivated, focused. The team that won game one on the road is kind of happy and satisfied, and they just get buried in game two. So I would think that would happen in game two. Denver's now laying 5.5. If I'm Minnesota, you know what? Get greedy. Instead of just being 1-1, which is a good scenario. Hey, 1-1, you would assign that going into game one. Hey, we get a split. We did our job. And that's why these teams, when they win game one, there's that level of satisfaction. But if I'm Minnesota, I don't want to say end the series, but you could basically put Denver on the canvas here. Down 2-0 going back to Minnesota where you're in great shape, where Denver's going to have to win 4 out of 5. Without home court, you know, in the next couple of games. If I'm Minnesota, I want to get greedy here. I want blood. I want to win this game. And don't just mail it in and say, hey, we got our split. Again, I kind of think Denver gets them in game two and just because of that trend. But Minnesota's a hungry team. They did that to Phoenix where they said, you know what, we're up 2-0, but we're going to finish it. We're going to bury you in game three and we're going to win game four. So I'm not as confident in Denver. It would be, if I had to bet it, I would lay the 5.5 just because of that trend. But Minnesota is a good team in Minnesota. Look, I picked this Denver in 7, so I'm not going to just jump off after one game. And if it's 1-1, hey, long series. And I do think we're looking at a long series. But there are some matchups here that really favor Minnesota. First of all, everything Denver does, floaters, layups, back cuts, everything in the paint, alley-oops. Minnesota's size is very disruptive. And it is very hard to get clean shots off against that defense with their size, with not just Gobert, Reed and Towns. Positionally, they're very long and athletic with McDaniels and Edwards. And Denver doesn't get to the little free throw line a lot, and they don't really kill you from three, and Murray doesn't look healthy. So again, I picked Denver in 7. If you're asking me right now who wins the series, I'll still say Denver. But if you gave me a lie detector test, I don't know that I'd pass. I think Denver might be in some trouble here. Again, long series. They still have Jokic. They still, if they can just get one in Minnesota and, you know, make this 1-1 and get one in Minnesota. Hey, you get a 7th game at home, and I did pick a Denver in 7. I don't know here. Minnesota's live. Minnesota to me is very live. And I'd be careful about just assuming Denver crushes them in game two. Although that, again, that's just, we've seen it so many times where these teams dominate. I'll say this. Not only if Denver loses game two, are they obviously in huge trouble? If this is competitive, this is a 3-point game, 2-point game with 5 minutes to go, I think that's major, major trouble for Denver just in terms of long-term, because Minnesota does have some advantages here. So hoping we get a good series, a long series. Minnesota is very good and very live here. The other series in the West, OKC, minus 120 against Dallas. This is interesting because this opened some places OKC with minus 140, which was too high. Other places, Dallas was like a small favorite. So again, we've settled somewhere between OKC laying 3.5 in game one. To me, this is a fascinating series. Total coin flip. I would pick OKC here. Again, I don't know that I like it enough to bet it, but I just think OKC's been overlooked here, where people look at him and say, hey, great, great young core, great future. Yeah, they do have a great young core. They do have a great future, but their present is really good. They're really good right now, and they have a good home court. That's a team that's not hasn't been good in a while. There's not a lot going on in Oklahoma City, so when their Thunder are good, they show up and they're loud and they affect the game. Obviously, you'd want Luka among all these players, but Shai is just a level, just a notch below Luka. And you know, this is going to be a back and forth series. I'll tell you what I like here. Over 5.5 games, it's juiced. It's minus 170, but this is going to be a 6 or 7 game series. Nobody's sweeping. Nobody's winning 5. If you can just bet over 5.5 games and just bet basically, hey, somebody's going to win 6 or 7 and not even have to figure out who, I think that's probably the best way to play it. I think we are looking at a long series here, Mavericks and Thunder. Again, I'll just go kind of chalk here. I'll go conservative, and not conservative, but just kind of boring, where I'll defer to home team in 7. Where long series and just the tiebreaker being that Oklahoma City does have the final game at home, the extra game at home. If this were in Dallas, I would certainly pick Dallas. If this were neutral, it's an interesting question. If this were on a neutral court, who would I pick? The fact that I have to think about it forces me to kind of pick Oklahoma City because this is in Oklahoma City. So if I can't decide who I'd pick on a neutral court, I have to take Oklahoma City when they have home court. That's just kind of where I'm at. Would not be surprised if Dallas won. And how weird would that be if it's a Dallas-Minnesota conference finals, even a Oklahoma City-Minnesota conference finals? I know, I'm sure David Stern will be tossing in his grave at the thought of that. But hey, you get Luka possibly in it. It's just, it would certainly be a weird one. Although Edwards is emerging as one of the next stars, the next star. I mean, he's got a little Dwayne Wade in him. He's got a little Kobe. He actually shoots it much, much better than Wade. So, I mean, he is, I know people throw around the Jordan comparison. I think that's blasphemy, even though I guess I just did it. But Edwards is a tremendous young player. So, fun teams left, fun series. As far as the East, I think the Knicks are going to bring a level of toughness and intensity that Indiana is not going to be able to handle. Indiana is not going to be able to handle them on the glass. Knicks are going to have to stretch out this rotation a little more because they've basically been playing 6 guys. They've been playing at the end of the Philly series, they played the 3 Nova guys, they played Ananobi, and they played the 2 bigs. You're going to have to start to integrate more guys, the Burks, the Ochoas of the world. You can't just run these guys into the ground every night. So at least early in the series, just get your home. It's only game one. I would expect that we start to see a little bit of a longer rotation. Knicks laying 6. I mentioned the other night when I did the podcast right after Knicks Sixers ended, minus 205 was light. It's up to minus 250. It's up to minus 300 at FanDuel. That minus 245 still light. I like Knicks -1.5 games, minus 125. To me, the Knicks win, and they win in 6 or less. I mean, that's the bet. I will pick it Knicks in 5. Wouldn't be shocked if it goes 6. I wouldn't be shocked if it's a sweep. I just think Indiana's a soft team. They didn't really impress me, but okay, you beat, Milwaukee without their best players. Congratulations. I just think the Knicks with that home court, with their toughness, their rebounding, I think the Knicks win this series, and I'll call it Knicks in 5. I would not be surprised, if the Knicks, I just think it's going to follow this formula. I think the Knicks get their 2 games at home. They get the split in Indiana, and they come home and they close it out in 5. And again, that garden is going to be rocking. It's possible we have New York, Boston in the conference finals in the NBA and in the NHL with the Rangers and the Bruins as a conference finals possibility. So I'm sure ESPN would love that. All the New York, Boston stuff, all, MSG filled up, Boston filled up for these next couple of weeks. I mean, we're still a couple of weeks away from that, but I do think we're getting New York, Boston in the East. And I mean, who knows about the hockey? Hockey is so random, but I think the Knicks will take care of business pretty quickly here with the Pacers. And I'm surprised this line's a little light. I think they're a much better, much tougher team. This Knicks team is than the Pacers. Quickly on baseball, before we get to Andy McCullough, haven't talked baseball in a while, nothing earth shattering going on. You look at the AL East. I think I've mentioned this. I think Yankees Orioles is going to be a down to the wire pennant race September, maybe even the last weekend. The Orioles kind of put the Yankees in their place last week, beat them 3 out of 4. Yankees couldn't hit. Yankees had a nice comeback victory against the Tigers on Friday, and that got them going a little bit. But to me, those teams are both going to be in the mid to upper 90s. That's a good race. Tampa's not in the mix anymore. It finally caught up to them. All the injuries, Franco being out. This is just not a Tampa team. They always do more with less, but they just don't have the talent to actually do that this year. The Red Sox have played better than people think. Toronto's always seems to be disappointing. So that's going to be the Yankees and the Orioles coming down to the wire. But the one team I wanted to mention, the one bet I wanted to mention, the Oakland A's headed into Sunday at 500. They are 200-1 to be the 6th seed. Now, you can bet all these individual seedings at DraftKings. If they make the playoffs, they're 25-1 to make the playoffs. If they make it, they're probably not winning the division. It's going to take 89, 90 wins to win the division. They're not that kind of team, but they've got a good bullpen. They've got a decent rotation with Wood, with Stripling. Mason Miller at the back end. Blackburn's a very underrated pitcher. If they can get to like 84, 85 wins, be kind of last year's Marlins where they sneak in, the sixth seed at 200-1, I just think that's mispriced. That shouldn't be 200-1. And there's a little vibe with, hey, they don't want us, let's rally around that. There's a little Major League Cleveland Indians vibe to it with Rick Vaughn at the end of the game. You compare that to Mason Miller, just that, hey, it's us against the world, that kind of thing. So Oakland at 200-1 to be the sixth seed, I think is fascinating. So again, we'll do baseball more going forward here as the NBA playoffs will die down before you know it. And I'll start to do more baseball, but it's just hard every day to, individual games aren't important enough unless there's an award bet out there, which I don't know that there is. Judge at 18-1 starting to heat up. Maybe you just take a flyer at him as MVP and say, you know what, bad month, but he can get past that. There's enough time where he's going to have his week where he hits 10 homers in 8 games and then he's back in the mix and you're just happy you have the 18-1. I know he's going to be hard pressed to beat out Soto, who's on his own team, but again, it's a long season, a lot of baseball to be played. Very hard. If Judge is healthy, getting him at 18-1 is just, it's a bet you don't get too much. So keep that in mind. Again, we'll do plenty of baseball here as the playoffs not wind down yet. We're only in the second round, but there's going to be plenty of summer to do baseball. Once the NBA ends, it's basically nothing but baseball until we get football closely, which will be here, which, you start, we're already May 6th. Playoffs end, and I've been over this, not to repeat it, but playoffs end takes you to the middle of June, and then you're a month, 6 weeks away from training camp, preseason, so we'll have plenty of time to do baseball. But the A's at 200-1 to be the sixth seed, I just think that's mispriced. I think that should not be the number. It should be much lower. When they're 25-1 to make the playoffs, they shouldn't be 200-1 to be the sixth seed, because they're probably, and they're 200-1 to be the five seed too. If you want to just take a couple of bucks, pizza money, and sprinkle it between the five and the six, they're probably not getting the three and winning the division or the four or anything like that. If they do get in, it would have to be sneaking in. Of course, they can look like the team of last year and just start to play poorly and this will look like a dumb bet. That's entirely possible, but it's not that bad of a team here. It's really not. They are vastly improved from what they were last year. They got a good bullpen. They got some good arms. It's not a terrible team, and that's a fun bet to have in your pocket. But we'll do a little more baseball with Andy McCullough of The Athletic. That is next. This is the Should've Bet More podcast. All right, we are back. Should've Bet More podcast. He is a senior writer for The Athletic. He is the author of a great new book called The Last of His Kind, biography of Clayton Kershaw. And he joins us now. It is Andy McCullough. Andy, what's going on, man? Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We'll get into the book shortly here, but just some big picture baseball questions. When you hear this, and I hear this all the time, and I have a hard time fighting back, but when you hear that baseball is dying, do you push back? What is your reaction to that statement?
Oh, I don't care. I don't know. I mean, like, when someone tells you that, they clearly believe it. And I write about baseball for a living. So, I don't know that necessarily my job is to like try and argue with people who think that. Baseball is doing perfectly fine. It's like an $11 billion industry. Players are, they have the best union in, professional sports. Like, they have tons of attendance, they play more games. Like, I think baseball is doing fine. You can make arguments about like its cultural relevance. I think that in general, it's just struggles compared to football, because football is just so much more popular than anything else. I mean, I think that, it seems less popular than the NBA, but I think that's just more from a cultural or I don't know. The NBA does like drama really well. Baseball tends to do sort of dumb scandals better. Baseball's fine. I don't know. But usually when someone tells you that, they just kind of want to argue and like, life's too short, I got stuff to do.
I like that. Yeah. And I'm a baseball guy. So I don't know. I know where they're coming from though. Like, when I was a kid, like I'm late 30s. When I was a kid, man, it was Ken Griffey Jr. and the Yankees were big. It does feel like it's not as, and you mentioned cultural is probably the best word, where it's just not in like the, kids in high school, college, they're not talking about it like they used to, like when we were kids.
I mean, I think that's true though for all sports, right? Like, the youths are, they're like less engaged in professional sports in general. We live in a more atomized culture, there's more access to different, forms of entertainment. It's become an extremely regionalized sport. But I don't think that's all that different from the other, major sports besides the NFL.
The umpire seems like every day you see something with an umpire getting a call wrong. Boone got thrown out a week or two ago where he didn't even say anything. These umpires, the CB Buckners, the Angel Hernandez, just feels like this has come to a point where they're sensitive about the fact that, hey, robots, technology could replace them. The calls are getting worse, or at least more publicized. When you talk to people around baseball, what is the sense? Is there something that's going to be done about this? Is this just part of the game? What are your thoughts here on the umpires?
Well, the robot ump is coming in some form or fashion. I mean, they don't implement things in the minors if they're not going to bring them up to the majors, right? They're testing it out now. I do think, to be honest, I think the umpires get an undue amount of criticism. I think they're in general really good, like really, really good at their jobs. I think they've gotten notably better in the last 10 to 15 years. I think there are some obvious outliers, you know, in terms of performance. I think that they are more, I think that we have given basically players and coaches and managers free rein to just sort of harass these guys all day long and just scream at them and curse at them and behave in ways that, like, in normal society, we've sort of decided that's not how you want to treat people. And then when the umpire, their only real recourse is to throw someone out when they are like, all right, get out of here. It's like that umpire's making it all about himself. It's like, no, maybe he's just annoyed that that manager swears at him every day. You know, when he's trying to do his job and is generally pretty good at his job. So, I mean, I think the robo umps are going to be, you know, they're going to be phased in. I think in general, most people don't necessarily want that. I think they like, you know, working with umpires. I think umpires are generally, as I said, really good. There's just some outliers that get more attention now. And I honestly believe there's just a misconception in the public about, like, how good these guys are. And the idea that umpires come to the ballpark trying to make it about themselves is just kind of preposterous.
When you say robot umps are coming, do you think, like, because I don't know if that's what I want, but I don't mind. Like, I've seen the challenge system in the minors where, hey, bad call, the batter taps his head, they quickly fix it. Is that kind of what you mean? Is that
where
we're starting? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's where it would start, yeah. And I think, you know, and that's something that a lot of players have been talking about for years. Like, I know, you know, used to cover the Dodgers, and, like, Rich Hill would always talk about, like, he would throw curveballs at the top of the zone, and the umpire would just sort of kind of give up on it because, like, visually you're like, okay, that's a curveball. There's no way that's a strike, you know. And then he would be like, no, it does – you know, you have to stick with it. And so I understand from the player's perspective is that they, you know, they're trying as hard as they can. They want to be rewarded for, you know, hitting sort of the rectangle. And so, yeah, I think the challenge system would be the way that it would be implemented. I don't know how close that is, though.
When the Ohtani scandal happened, I think a lot of people, myself included, were skeptical. This is the real story. It appears that was. What was your reaction when it came out? And this has kind of died down where, I guess, you know, Ohtani was telling the truth and this guy was stealing money from Ohtani. Is that where were you at with this story? And
yeah.
Go ahead.
I had to cover a lot of it for The Athletic. And so I was pretty deep in the weeds and talking to folks, you know, about it. And so I think that, as you said, you know, Ipe Mizuhara, he has turned himself in. There's an expectation that he's going to plead guilty. I do not believe he has entered a plea yet. I believe he's supposed to be arraigned on the 9th. But there's an expectation that he's going to plead guilty and cooperate. And the charging document that was presented by the federal authorities, you know, laid out a, you know, pretty convincing case that, you know, Mizuhara did steal from Ohtani. Ohtani has maintained, you know, from the beginning that he had no idea what was going on. And so I think, you know, at first blush, it's like kind of a crazy thing to believe, right? That someone is able to steal that much money from you without your knowledge. But, you know, that appears to be what has happened. You know, crazy things are possible. So I think that, and there was, you know, the reason for the skepticism, right, is like anytime a story changes, that means someone's lying, right? So it's like either Mizuhara's lying in the first version he told to ESPN, or Ohtani's lying in the second version, you know, that when Mizuhara recanted or whatever, right? So it just hurts everyone's, you know, credibility, because you just know that someone's, you know, when the story changes, someone has lied somewhere. But yeah, I mean, based on everything that, you know, the government has been able to bring in so far in the investigation, you know, it seems like Ohtani's told the truth. Mizuhara stole the money to, you know, fund his gambling debts, which he did, you know, without Ohtani's knowledge. Ohtani is said to basically sleep all day when he's not at the ballpark. So I guess that's a lot of time to be, you know, firing up bets on college soccer and stuff. So yeah, but it was it has died down a bit for, like, something that was probably the craziest story in quite some time.
Yeah, so I mean, it appears baseball did dodge a bullet, and if it turned out Ohtani was betting, it would be just obviously a whole different level to that story. But you know, you talk to people around baseball. Do they? We've had football players get suspended for betting. We've had the Jante Porter in the NBA. Mm-hmm. Does baseball? Do you get the sense? Hey, baseball players bet. They got a lot of time on their hands. They sure. You know, they watch football. They watch these other sports. Do you get the sense? Hey, with all this betting being prevalent, that a betting scandal, a betting controversy, is just a matter of time.
I mean, it happened. It just happened with Ohtani, right? Like, and while it appears, you know, that he's not guilty of anything, he hasn't been, you know, accused of anything. Like, you've already seen how possible it is. And look, like, lots of people, you know, gamble on sports now. It's something that has been effectively legalized, you know, in a majority of the country. And so, baseball's concern is they don't want athletes betting on baseball, and that's a pretty, you know, solid red line that has existed for forever. And, you know, it's like the one rule that, you know, rule 21 that everyone in baseball knows. And, you know, I think that their main concern in any of these, you know, investigations is, did the person bet on baseball? Because if the person is like illegally betting on, you know, college basketball games through a bookie, baseball is not thrilled about that. But you know, the punishments for that are more like a, you know, it's like a fine. Maybe there would be a suspension, but the precedent suggests it would be a fine. If you were caught betting on a baseball game in any form, a game you're not involved in, it's a year-long suspension. If you bet on a game you're involved in, it's a permanent ban. I mean, the rules are like, they're as harsh as possible for this. So outside of that deterrent, I'm not totally sure what they can do at this point.
Where do you stand on the baseballs? A lot of people think the baseballs are dead. You talk to players, are the balls inconsistent and the balls just not flying out as much? What's going on here with the
ball?
Which
is it this year? They're dead this year?
I think they're dead this year.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see. I mean, they're dead. Then some years they're alive. Then some years they're mushy.
Yes.
Then some years, I mean, it's one of the hallmarks of Rob Manfred's commissionership is that the ball, the composition of the ball comes into question every year. I think it's early. I think that pitching has never been better. I think the weather is bad. The ball normally behaves in a more deader fashion at this time of year than any other time. And so I tend not to get too wrapped up in like a month long sample. But yeah, it's, you know, we could in June when the weather is better and all of a sudden the ball's soaring out again, we might hear that the balls are alive. I tend to think that they're fine. But you know, players continue to gripe about it.
Do you hear that from players though? Just either on the record, off the record, that, hey, this ball's different. This ball's not moving. This ball's doing whatever.
I haven't talked to any guys about the balls this year, just cause like, I don't care, you know? And like, that's not to be rude to your question. It's just like, you know, if guys want to, they're griping. I didn't even know that the guys were griping about the balls this year. You know, it's kind of a fact of life.
It's more so betting community, because a lot of people will bet on home runs and bases. And like, obviously, if you're betting on these games, it takes into account the total, things like that. So,
right. Well, how do they know the ball's dead?
I think I'm trying to look for the stat as we talk out. There's some stats where like this many balls were hit at this exit velocity, this launch angle last year, and this X percentage of them went out. And this year, it's not close to that. So there is some data that backs it up. But again, it's you know, minor issue unless you're betting these games, betting the total. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, is that controlled for the time of year and temperature?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it's starting to get a little warmer, but you know, you do bring up a good point where, hey, maybe that is part of it. Before we get
pitching's just gotten a lot better. Anyway, sorry.
I mean, no, these guys. I mean, they all throw hard. They all throw with a lot of movement. It's incredible. Yeah. The book. Kershaw, fascinating subject. You know, you hear Kershaw's name and I think people think, I guess, two different things. One of the best regular season pitchers of all time, but a postseason resume that is nowhere close to the regular season resume, where the regular season resume is 95% of what he's done and the postseason's 5%. It's just how, you know, we are as sports fans, where we look at guys' playoff performances. Is Kershaw aware of that? Does he object to some of that? What are Kershaw's thoughts on the splits between the regular season and the postseason?
Yeah, I mean, very, very aware of it. Has suffered through, you know, the pain of those experiences, I think, a lot more acutely than anyone else. I think that You know, one of the challenges in the book is that I don't think there's an overarching explanation for the difference, you know, and, you know, his ERA in the postseason is about 2 runs higher than his regular season ERA. His regular season ERA, by the way, is the lowest in baseball history. So, you know, you're dealing with a pretty good bar there. I think that it kind of goes through various eras. You know, there were times early in his career, you know, in 13 and 14, where perhaps he was a victim of, you know, a bit of stubbornness in his approach. There were times where he was playing on teams where they did not have a particularly effective bullpen. And so he was asked to go for an inning too long, and that affected things. There were times when he just had bad luck. There were times when he just had bad performances. And if you go through, you know, all the starts he's made in his postseason career, there's a lot of really, really good ones. They just get less attention than the blowups, because that's just the standard he'd set for himself. So yeah, I mean, I think it's the, he's very aware of it. I think he doesn't have a particular explanation. I think that he's talked about how in the past he, you know, was dealing from a position of fear in the postseason. It's not that he so much was afraid when he was out there, but his what drove him, I guess, was just a fear of failure. And as he's gotten older, he's tried to just be driven more by, you know, the idea of, you know, the hoping for the triumph of success. And so, you know, he's had better results in certain postseasons, you know, especially in 2020 when they won. But it's something that is still important to him as he comes back, you know, from shoulder surgery. He wants to, you know, be able to pitch again in October and show people he can do it.
It's tough because the 2021, and I don't think this is fair, but I just think it's the reality where it just kind of gets swept up. 60-game season, sure. World Series, no fans. Does he get that sense? Do you get that sense where, hey, I know it happened. I know he won the World Series. He had some good performances, but ..
Yeah, I think it's something that in the moment, like in 2020 and even into the next spring, it was very much like, hey, we won. Like, we won. It's over. Like, got the ring, got the monkey off my back, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, my personal opinion is like, look, if they were going to play that stupid season, you might as well make it count, right? Like, you know, that season was just a nightmare from beginning to end. They played, you know, the best team won. They were, that Dodgers team, you know, is like probably the best team that's been assembled in the last 20 years. You know, so like they should take credit for it. But I think that what has happened, maybe to a lesser extent with Kershaw, but definitely within the Dodgers organization, is the value of that championship has been reduced somewhat as the team gets more and more frustrated with how their postseasons have gone in 21 and 22, you know, less so last year. They were frustrated last year, but like they kind of knew that team was flawed. But, you know, I think that as they get more, you know, bitter or just frustrated with like not being able to punch through on teams in 21 and 22, which were so good, the 2020 championship has been cheapened a little bit. They have no signage for that at Camelback Ranch, their spring training facility. There's no banner that says 2020 World Champions.
Wow.
There's no, like, you know, if you walk into Surprise Stadium where the Texas Rangers play, right, there's huge banners and stuff like World Series Champions, right? And there's none of that at Camelback Ranch. You know, there's no, like, acknowledgement of the fact that they won the World Series. And so it's kind of in a weird limbo where, like, I think that it was very much a relief for Kershaw. It was very much a relief for the organization. It's something that they are proud of, but they are very much interested in getting one more at the very least.
It's funny because it's a chilly day here and you can't see this and I didn't plan this, but I'm a Laker fan. I'm wearing my Lakers 2020 NBA championship.
Oh my gosh. So, yeah, that's right.
What a weird.
Yeah. Like, I imagine it's similar to how like the Lakers feel about it, right?
I would
say, like, as a Lakers fan, I'd be curious.
I would say the Lakers, they played pretty much 90-something percent of a regular, normal season. Then sure, they went into the bubble and they're the best team all year, so you can't – they played, they won it. I don't dismiss anything. I just get the sense with the Dodgers it gets dismissed. As a Laker fan, when people say, hey, it doesn't count, I mean, look, they were the best team all year. They're the best team in the playoffs.
Yeah.
I think it's a real championship, and I felt the same way about the Dodgers, but I just get the sense with Kershaw that, hey, people – you know what? They've choked since. Who cares? It was a 60-game season. Doesn't really count.
Yeah, I think what's funny to me is, like, when people say, oh, it's a 60-game season, it's like, did you think the Dodgers weren't going to make the playoffs? Exactly.
I mean, like, I think they went 46-14. I mean, they played dominant
at the same pace as the 2001 Seattle Mariners. Like, it's the best team in the last 20 years. It's an incredible baseball team. And there wasn't even a trade deadline where they could have, like, added, right? So I look at it as, like, if you want to discount it, you know, you can discount it because it's a weird COVID season. There was no off days in the postseason. Like, you know, but it's just sort of like, look, they played – enough of a season that it was very clear who the best team was. They played a bigger tournament than they'd ever played before. Yep. And the Dodgers won at the end. If you're not going to count that, okay, whatever. I don't care, but I certainly wouldn't begrudge Dodgers fans, Dodgers employees, Dodgers players from championing it as a real title. Cause it is.
Yep. That gets lost because they had to play Milwaukee in a best 2 out of 3 and nobody, and that was before this extra round of playoffs. And yeah, even now they wouldn't have to do that, which that's a very tricky series. Anyone can lose 2 out of 3.
You got to flip a coin. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Like, you know, so, and they played, you know, these weird series that had no off days, which actually benefited them because it was more like the regular season. But even so, I mean, I don't know. The 60 game season thing, if the Dodgers had gone 30-30 that year, I think you can maybe make that argument. They were very clearly the best team in baseball.
And they were down 3-1 in the NLCS to the Braves and losing in game 5. And I don't know if you remember the game. The Braves had men on base all night.
Oh, yeah.
One hit. It was 4-0. It would have been 4-0, 5-0. I think that was the game Will Smith went deep off the other Will Smith. And that kind of took the game where these people that are anti-Dodgers, if they lost that series, people would use it against them, but they won. So it doesn't count. So, I mean,
I get that people, you know, like for fans, like if you want to discount it, that's fine. The whole point of, you know, being a fan is talking shit on other fans. It's fun. But like, I feel like for, you know, people in the industry to discount it, that feels a little silly to me.
Why is it called The Last of His Own, Last of His Kind, which is a great book, and I encourage people to get it.
Yeah, because what interested me about, there's a lot of things that interested me about Kershaw, but I really believe that he is pretty much the last ace that baseball was going to produce. You know, Gerrit Cole has a chance, you know, if he's able to come back healthy and to be a sort of guy. But the way that the sport has changed its expectations and its sort of requirements for what it means to be a number one starter, I think Kershaw really is the last one who's ever going to like fill that sort of void, both from a statistical you know, standpoint and from a narrative standpoint. And I thought that the way that he's, you know, sort of conducted his career, you know, the selflessness he demonstrated in a variety of, you know, postseason, you know, opportunities, pitching on short rest, coming out of the bullpen, all that stuff are things that are no longer expected or even asked of, you know, from top level pitchers. And I wanted to sort of get into that, you know, and through the book. And also it sounds cool, you know, so that was a big part of it, is I thought like the title sounded good. So, yeah.
Does he see, and get you out of here in a couple minutes, does he see Bumgarner's career and say, hey, I'm much better than this guy, but everyone loves Bumgarner as this great, like, postseason performer. I know I'm better than him. Does that frustrate him? Because there's a natural parallel, same era, same division, both left-handed pitchers.
Yeah. Well, it's in the book. Madison Bumgarner thinks Clayton Kershaw is the best pitcher who ever lived. Wow. So, you know, I think Kershaw has a lot of respect for Bumgarner and, you know, has, you know, really admires the way he's conducted himself, but only one of those guys is going to be pitching in 2024, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting comparison, you know, and it's an interesting way of looking at how reputations kind of become fixed, I guess. You know, cause Bumgarner has won 3 championships, and I'm not saying this to take away from him in any way. Right. He was the number 4 starter on the team in 2010. He was not particularly good in 2012 in the postseason. And in 2014, he was incredible. Like, you know, it was one of the best, you know, I covered the Royals then. I remember being at Kauffman Stadium when he came in the 5th inning of game 7. And I was just like, this guy's not leaving till this game's over. But, you know, that was, you know, incredible. But I think that doing what he did in 2014, it becomes this sort of halo that goes around, and whatever else happens for the rest of his career, you know, he's sort of knighted as a, you know, this postseason great. And look, he had a great career. He's, you know, been wonderful, but he's never had a regular season close to what Kershaw does in an average regular season. You know, he's never finished higher than 3rd in a Cy Young voting. And he's had a lot fewer postseason opportunities in part because of that. You know, part of the reason that Kershaw's in the postseason every year is because he was the best pitcher in baseball for so many seasons and was able to get his team, you know, into the dance. And so I think it's just kind of an unfair comparison for both, in that in order to explain why Kershaw is so much better, you almost have to be rude about Bumgarner, you know. But like, yeah, it's you know, they're not super close, but they're friendly. And I think there's a lot of, you know, mutual respect there.
Yeah, it's just how people view the sport, where Kershaw is a much, much better performer, much better pitcher than Bumgarner ever was. And then Bumgarner just feels like he's viewed more positively. By the way, should they have sent Alex Gordon on that night in game seven? Watching it live, I thought they should have, but I never got a good angle.
I agree. Yeah, in the moment, I was like, you got to send him. And then, you know, up and down in the organization, they're like, are you crazy? Like, you know, he would have been out, as Mike Gerschle, the third base coach, famously said, you know, someone asked him, was like, you know, were you afraid that you were gonna send a guy and the World Series would end on a play at the plate? And he goes, no, if I sent the guy, the World Series would have ended in a rundown. Like, he was getting, like, he had no chance, he basically felt like. But in the moment, I was like, oh, he's 100% getting sent here. That was that was a fun game.
I think it was Halloween night. I think it was.
It might have been. Yeah,
I think it was. All right. Last one before we get out of here. Appreciate your time. This is a betting show. So any predictions you want to make on the record, anyone you think is going to win a World Series award, Rookie of the Year, MVP.
Oh,
if people if you get it wrong, nobody's going to remember. If you get it right, we'll just, you know, we'll promote it and, you know, you can victory lap.
Sure. Shohei Ohtani will be the National League MVP.
Okay. Okay. I know a lot of people like, how do you pronounce it? Paez for Rookie of the Year.
Yeah, Paez.
On strong. It's a great rookie good. Class.
Yeah. He's been good. Yeah. Yeah. It's just hard with rookies. You know, he's a guy who like had kind of holes in his swing in the minors. And so, like, when a guy like that who has questions about him comes up and has success, you wonder, like, okay, is it good luck? You know, when will pitchers figure him out and something like that? But I think the Phillies have a real chance to win the National League East. I think, you know, the Braves losing Spencer Strider kind of puts them at a disadvantage in a way that they just haven't been. I think that's going to be a lot more competitive of a race. That's about it. I don't know. It's been an interesting season so far, but there's, you know, the only major thing I feel like that has happened that kind of changes anyone's like sort of championship potential is, you know, Strider going out.
Yeah, and it's just the nature of baseball now. It's the nature of the postseason. You just get in and you hope the ball bounces your way, because there's really not a lot of rhyme or reason in terms of, hey, this is the best team. Well, yeah, well, they're the best team in May. We'll see how they do, you know, Columbus Day weekend.
Exactly, yeah.
Andy, you're the best. Let everyone know where they can find you, where they can find the book.
Yeah, sure. You know, the book will be out on Tuesday. If you want to get in a pre-order before then, that would be great. Pre-orders are good for business, but, you know, you can go wherever you buy books, you know, bookshop.org. If you want to support, you know, one of your local indies, you know, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, you know, if you buy books from a place, that's a place that sells this book. So, you know, please give it a shot. I worked hard on it and I want people to read it.
All right. The book is called The Last of His Kind. Andy McCullough, appreciate a few minutes here. Hopefully we'll catch up here down the road.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, that will do it. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to Andy McCullough. We will be back middle of the week. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe. See you guys then.